So it's all about the secrets, the way that money is handled, the first time that this has been broken down and definitively broken down, as well as Jason Berry has done the clergy sex abuse scandal. You'll understand it completely. As heartbreaking as some of that is, we'll get to your questions and comments about the Vatican Bank, the massive international real estate holdings. Just how much money is in the Vatican Bank? What does the Vatican actually own? And we'll get to all of that coming up with you next, too, on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. So, again, the book is available. You can now link up to it through coasttocoastam.com. Render Unto Rome, The Secret Life of Money in the Catholic Church. And questions and comments we're lining up right now. I think there's a couple of wildcard lines you could grab. But did you want to finish up that thought? I was—I know I had to steal you away there just before the last second.
No, that's fine. I think I made the point.
Okay, very good. Bob, first-time caller line, Chandler, Arizona, has been hanging on the longest for Jason Berry. Go ahead, Bob.
Hi, thanks for having me. I give you just a bit of background of myself. I was a plaintiff in a jury trial that went to verdict out of Oakland, California. And I was represented by Jeffrey Anderson, Father Thomas Doyle, who you mentioned earlier, testified at that trial. And it was a 3-year process going through that. And so you mentioned San Diego and the vast wealth of land that wasn't disclosed there. And in Oakland, my attorneys did massive research and found hundreds of millions of dollars of real estate that was available. A couple things that struck me as odd during the entire trial, it was fairly well publicized, was just the lack of logic and the lack of change. I mean, there's still really been no change in the church to speak of. At the same time that we were in trial, they were building a $120 million Cathedral of Light in Oakland.
Yeah.
And they built that light, they built that cathedral during that. And it was very precarious the way it was funded and the way they presented that, because that became a point of contention in the trial. And so I just wondered if that's something that was common, why they're closing parishes left and right and building, they did it in Los Angeles, they've done it all over the country. Why would they be building $100 million cathedrals when they're lacking funds in the first place? And, and you hit on it, the massive amount of land holdings that they have, it's just immense.
Well, you raise a very good point. And let me just say that you're an abuse survivor, and my heart goes after you for what you suffered. I have a long chapter on Jeff Anderson, the attorney, and Cardinal Mahoney of Los Angeles. It's called Another California. And although I don't deal with the cases in Oakland, I am certainly aware of them. I made three trips to California over the years and followed a number of those cases. The building of the cathedral in Oakland, I don't really know what to say beyond what you have said quite eloquently. It could not have come at a worse time for the diocese, because here they were in court trying to bargain down, or through the legal system, before yours went to trial, trying to bargain down.
And that case, incidentally, seemed to set our verdict number, seemed to set the benchmark for all the settlements, if not just across California, across the country, for the remainder of the cases. And yet they still built these things. Sorry to interrupt you. I just wanted to say that.
No, that's
they
fine.
They kind of knew what they were in for and what they were going to pay.
If you look at what happened in Los Angeles, Cardinal Mahoney completed a $100 million cathedral in 2002 as the abuse crisis was erupting. It was really rolling from the East Coast across the heartland toward California, and his attorneys saw what happened in Boston, where the judge allowed the personnel files to be released, and it was on the basis of those files that the Boston Globe began its reporting. Other newspapers around the country began to make similar requests in court. Mahoney's attorneys fought for the better part of 7 years to keep the clergy personnel files from being released. Nevertheless, there was, you know, a long tide of litigation. But what's so fascinating to me about Mahoney, and I would ask the caller to compare this mentally with what happened in Oakland, you know, up the highway. Mahoney managed to generate $700 million to resolve the many cases in that archdiocese. It is the largest archdiocese in the United States and by far the wealthiest. And the reason he was able to do it was twofold. Three reasons. First, he strong-armed the Salesian order to come to the plate and put up a substantial amount of money to resolve their portion of the cases. Secondly, he had the benefit of parishes that were widely spread out compared to the East Coast, where you can have, say, you know, three parishes within a radius of four or five blocks. It was Cardinal McIntyre in the 1950s who planned parishes as he foresaw the way freeways would be laid out. I've got a whole section on how the urban grid of Los Angeles unfolded and how this, you know, long deceased Archbishop Cardinal made sure that parishes were widely spread out. So you have parishes with 4,000 and 5,000 families in Los Angeles. He went to those parishes, the Cardinal did, Mahoney, and basically asked them for financial support, and many of them gave it. He was able to sell an enormous amount of property, and finally, the Allied Irish Bank gave them a $200 million loan. Now, you ask yourself, why would any bank loan money to an archdiocese that's in the middle of, you know, trying to resolve abuse cases? Where is it going to get its return on its money? Allied Irish Bank has been involved in all kinds of diocesan financial bond issues, loans to build schools. And I had two lawyers tell me on the record that they suspected AIB was a sort of pass-through for Vatican support to the archdiocese to resolve its abuse crisis. I was never able to confirm that with the archdiocese or AIB, but the fact that they're still holding a $175 million loan indicates the enormous power that Mahoney had and was able to wield in Rome.
Let's go to Key. And by the way, Bob and Chandler, I am sorry for what happened to you too. Thank you for jumping in, being a great caller. Key is in Seattle, Washington, on Coast to Coast for Jason Berry.
Hi, Jason and Ian. I have a short story and then a question. My kids were taking catechism class during Mass at that church. And one Sunday, church got over, the Mass got over before the class was over, and I stepped into the class and sat down. And it was like a pep rally where the teacher, the priest who was teaching the catechism class, was saying, "And what does God want?" And the kid yelled out, "Money." And he said, "What are you going to do after church? Go ask our parents for money for God."
Oh,
and I stood up and I said, "God doesn't need money. Why are you lying to these children? You need the money to do God's work, but God doesn't need money." And he just kind of looked at me dumbfounded, you know, it's like, it just didn't make any sense. It was like a brainwashing, you know,
right.
Class.
Yeah, it does sound a little bit like that.
I've never heard of anything like that. That's amazing.
It was funny. But I took my kids out of that class, needless to say.
It's a very good idea.
The question I have is, do you know of anybody doing studies of what the nuns were involved, you know, how the nuns ran the schools and the problems
What did the nuns know and when did they know it? That kind of thing?
No, not just what the nuns know, but, you know, the issues that happened and came up around the nuns.
Are you talking about sexual issues? Or are you talking about
abusive issues?
Okay,
yeah.
All right.
Well, there have been scattered cases involving nuns who were either physically or sexually abusive to youngsters. But far fewer cases involving nuns than priests or religious brothers.
Yeah, I would imagine.
Excuse me. You know, the interesting thing about nuns in this regard is that, and many people don't realize this, but It was the order, the religious orders of nuns who staffed many, built and staffed many of the original hospitals that the Catholic Church erected in the United States. And they were, in a sense, the pioneers of a medical infrastructure that has obviously gone through many changes because of the transformation of, you know, American medicine. The Daughters of Charity, for example, you know, have a network of hospitals. Many hospitals, many of these are now being privatized. But without downplaying the fact that a small number of nuns have indeed abused youngsters, I have been rather impressed over the years by the number of nuns who have assisted me in the investigative reports I've done. I think there's a strong sense of social justice among within many of these religious communities of nuns.
I would think so. My wife mentioned this tonight. We were talking about it, and she went to a long history of Catholic schools, and her feeling was that the nuns would have said, if they were around today, that she knew then, is how much that would really chap them, that here they had given up children and family to be, you know, the bride of Christ and to work for a church, only to have priests that they worked with, in many cases, out there abusing kids and satisfying themselves sexually. That would have really bothered the nuns that my wife knew.
You know, interestingly, one of the figures in this book, Sister Christine Schenck, is a founder of a group called Future Church, and she is based in Cleveland. And they have been doing remarkable work. They've got a terrific website. They've worked extensively with abuse survivors. They've developed a liturgy of lament, which can be downloaded. And it is a service, you know, that any church can use, a kind of healing service, a liturgy for abuse victims. And they're also very much in the forefront of trying to gently push the bishops toward some sort of rational equilibrium on the celibacy issue.
Brooke is in Newport, Rhode Island, on coast to coast, east of the Rockies. Render Unto Rome. It's the new book about the secret life of money in the Catholic Church. Brooke?
Thank you for taking my call, Ian, and terrific show as always.
Thank you.
I have a couple questions for Jason, and it sounds like he did a terrific book, and I'll have to get the book.
You should.
But the two questions, one is in regards to Father Shanley, who was sent to California on the $1,700 a month pension. My question there is, do you think that they were trying to buy his silence? And the second question is in regards to the sale of the Archbishop's residence in Boston to Boston College. Boston College is a Roman Catholic university, meaning the Catholic Church just bought the Archbishop's residence back. And have they leased it to the Cardinal, or are they using it for the university? And I'll take my answer offline.
Well, those are both very good questions. With Shanley, yes, I think they were trying to buy his silence. I think they wanted him out of sight, out of mind. And the agreement was, look, we'll, you know, give you this pension, and you just go out there to the left coast and keep quiet and don't come back. Your question about the sale of the Cardinal's mansion and estate in Boston to Boston College is also quite on point. What's interesting about that is it's not just a transfer of money, you know, within the Catholic Church. Boston College is part of the consortium of, you know, Jesuit institutions of higher education, and they are using the ground, the facilities for expanded classroom space, and in fact, administrative space as well. In fact, I just learned recently one of the issues they're facing is they want to do a fairly extensive building program there. They want to build dormitories. Boston College has its own endowment. I mean, it functions completely apart in that sense from the archdiocese. There's no, you know, financial intermingling. The problem they've got is Cardinal O'Connell's tomb is right in the middle of this large acreage. And they're trying to figure out what to do with the tomb. If they can move the tomb, then they have room to expand and build. And in a city like Boston, for a major university, it's called a college, but it's really a university, they can't, you know, embark on their expansion plan until they figure out a way to move the tomb of the original first cardinal of the archdiocese. So I don't know what they're going to do with the granite, but that's the plan at this point. They're trying to figure out a way out of that.
You know, maybe this is the time to point out the difference between diocesan priests and priests of an order like the Jesuits or the Franciscans, and that a lot of what we're talking about here are the diocese system, you know, the regional parish system, and that they are the ones that seem to be some of the bigger heroes of your book are just, you know, workaday meat and potato diocesan priests who were the ones who were doing the heavy lifting on the streets of Boston.
Well, that's true. Steve Josima is a pastor in Dedham. Bob Bowers, who was the pastor in Charlestown, among others. Ron Coyne, who had a parish, St. Albert the Great in Weymouth. These were men who really put their necks on the line by standing up to the new archbishop. You know, what a lot of people can't appreciate, especially non-Catholics, is the enormous power that a given bishop has over his priests. He can, he has the power to move a priest, he can punish them, and, you know, a lot of these guys are very reluctant to speak up, to be critical of their bishop, because they don't want to face repercussions. Alternatively, some of the men in different parts of the country have really done that. What's so interesting in Cleveland right now is that there has been a flood of letters from priests and lay people to the papal nuncio, that is the Vatican ambassador in Washington, complaining about Bishop Lennon. And I think everyone is waiting to see what the nuncio will do. As I report in the book, he authorized an investigation of Bishop Lennon, and I think it's fair to say Lennon is a fairly beleaguered bishop at this point, although he's still in his position.
Kind of make you wonder what cushy job in Rome he'll be given later on. Let's go to Frank, in Corpus Christi, Texas, on Coast to Coast for Jason Berry. Frank?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for taking my call, Ian and Jason. I'm an old retired clergy here in South Texas, and I'm really impressed, Jason, with how on top of everything you are in your investigation. One comment I would make on the taking care of these guys that they sent off like to California, there's a deep thread of fraternalism. Once somebody is ordained, they take care of that person, irregardless. And on the other hand, Ian, regardless of what they do, traditionally they've looked at it from a moral sense. So in other words, this person asks for forgiveness, his sins are forgiven, he's washed clean, so to speak. So there's nothing wrong with them. And they were getting away with that for a long time until the civil authorities stepped in and started prosecuting them.
Well, that's certainly the story of your books. We have about 15 seconds if you want to respond.
Well, here, the good father just outlined a very important concept. Namely, they translate crimes into sins, and that's the real problem.
Yep. We'll just have to hang on to that thought, and we'll line up everybody else. I think we'll try and get you an open line. We'll try and clear out one of these for you to talk with Jason Berry. Coming up next, Render Unto Rome. You can link up to this book. You can buy it tonight. Go to coasttocoastam.com. It's a terrific, well-documented read. You'll really enjoy it. We got a full boat of calls. We'll get to everybody we can. Coming up for Jason Berry, Render Unto Rome. It is a amazingly laid out book. That is to say, you follow these stories until many of them converge closer to the end, and we fully understand exactly what's been happening at the higher, most secret levels of finance within the Catholic Church. And a lot of that information only came out because of the depositions and the discovery motions during the clergy sex abuse scandals. So it's really only understandable kind of for the first time in its complexity, at least as much as we can now, thanks to Jason Berry, who takes your calls next. On Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. I'm going to kick it off with Wade in Alberta, Canada, on Coast to Coast for Jason Berry. Wade?
Hi, guys. My question is, does the Vatican even have an auditor? This kind of sounds like government spending, doesn't it?
Well, the Vatican releases a financial statement every year, and it does not have the Vatican Bank listed as an asset. Now, you might ask, well, how can they issue a financial statement with a bank off the books? And the answer is every country writes its own standards for public accounting, you know, for the kinds of financial disclosures and the way in which finances are audited. And the Holy See, in its wisdom, decided that its own bank would not be listed on the financial statement that it publishes every year in the summer. You know, it's interesting, too, that the largest collection every year in American diocese is for Peter's Pence. This is the donation that goes directly to the Pope for his charitable uses. And in 2009, the Peter's Pence intake was about $82 million. Now, this is not just in the United States, but churches across the developed world, Germany, Canada, UK, what have you. And I did a lot of digging to try to find out how they spent the money. And the only figures that I could get out of the Vatican were $8.5 million. And these were for very worthy causes. Pope Benedict, for example, spent $250,000 in a donation to rebuild a school that had been destroyed in Port-au-Prince during the terrible earthquake in Haiti. That's where one would expect charitable donations to go. But the reality is most of the money is unaccounted for in terms of how it's spent. And what I learned doing the historical research is that for much of its history over the last 150 years, Peter's Pence has gone to pay the Vatican operating deficit.
Which is what you go into detail, too, on. That's not necessarily what people think when they're making these contributions. As so often is the case, people are led to believe this is going to be gone for go to a social justice cause. And there's nothing that says that some of it doesn't, but that the lion's share is actually going for to maintain the status quo. And in some cases, that just that doesn't seem justifiable. The just before we went to the break at the bottom of the hour, I had to stop you. Do you remember where you were and whether there was anything more you wanted to say?
No. I was just finishing that point on the question that the gentleman from Texas had raised.
Okay. Greg is in Mississippi on Coast to Coast on a wild card line for Jason Berry. Greg?
How you doing, man? I was just searching my iPad, and I'm always usually listening to you guys, and it's my first time ever calling. And I just wanted to say that with the Vatican having all the money and stuff, do you think it's not so much of a mystery, like, as far as they're spending to them, because it's basically a promissory note from the beginning, and most money in the world is pretty much like, we'll give it back to you once we're done, and they're such a big corporation. Knowing this, it's just not a mystery to them, so they just get it done. Because it's the usual thing. I mean, is that, okay.
Let me rephrase your question a little separately. I'll say, what's the difference between what Greg said, which is fair? What's the difference between operating it like that, which is, hey, we'll give back to you what we have extra after we're done with it, and a system of greater accountability? Because there's a couple of people you interview who were financial reformers who ran into great frustration with that.
Well, indeed. And I think the caller from Mississippi raises an interesting point, because when you have a system of secrecy involving money, there is no impetus to change it until it runs into problems. And what's happening now is that people are demanding higher standards of transparency and accountability. And the underlying problem, I said this, I think, in the first hour, but the real problem here is that the Vatican does not have a justice system. It doesn't have a court system as we have in democratic countries, whereby if a bishop does not use the money wisely or correctly, or is trampling the rights of individuals, there's very little recourse that people have under this archaic tribunal system that is in place in the Vatican today.
But even in the people that were accountants, they came into even at a parish level or at a diocesan level, and they came away very frustrated because they just wanted receipt. Like that one guy who had where the nuns were mad at him because they had a kind of a little slush fund, and he's like, all I want is a receipt that says, what did you spend it on? And they didn't want to do that.
Yes, that was the fellow in Boston who was hired to sort of reorganize the cardinal's office under Bernard Law. And he was imposing management standards. For example, you have to document what you do with petty cash and things like that. And everybody got upset with him. It was David Castaldi who eventually left that position and gave me a very good interview. You know, one of the things that I think needs to be borne in mind here is that, and I'm kind of echoing what I said a little bit earlier, this is the largest organization in the world, and it is vastly decentralized. And there's a lot of internal chaos. You know, some people have the idea that the Vatican has a supercomputer, you know, behind St. Peter's Basilica, something like that. Not the case. There is a good deal of disorganization and chaos within the church, despite this legal system that puts all of the power and benefits in the camp of the bishops and cardinals.
Sue is on the first-time caller line in Phoenix, Arizona, for Jason Berry on Coast to Coast. Sue?
Hi, Ian and Jason. Excellent program. Jason, I noticed that you have referred to the power of the cardinals and the bishops, but not the Pope. Can you tell us in your research, have you discovered that the Pope, specifically John Paul II, was strategically somehow sequestered so that he could claim lack of knowledge of these scandals and payoffs, like a form of deniability? Or was John Paul and now Benedict aware of all these happenings? And specifically, how much direct input and hands-on, power does the Pope have in these decisions and financial dealings?
Great questions.
Okay, let me take those questions in sequence. First of all, John Paul was deeply knowledgeable of the abuse crisis, and I've got a lot of information on that in this book, and the previous book I did, Vows of Silence, has a long section on when John Paul got information, when he made public statements, and his silence time and again as scandals erupted in the 1990s. The idea that John Paul didn't know or was not briefed is not true at all, and is certainly not borne out by the factual record. As to the second part of your question, the Pope has ultimate authority in canon law. You got to remember, this is a monarchy. That is the way the church is governed. I mean, that is simply a statement of political science. It's not an opinion. It is a monarchical power structure. Under the legal system, the Pope can intervene in any canon law proceeding at any time. He can reverse it, he can change it, he can kick it out, or he can simply let it continue. So when you ask about his role in finances, the Pope heard or received, I don't want to call it a brief, but it was a petition from these various parishes in the United States. And I referenced this in the last part of the book, where they were basically pleading with him to intervene and to halt, you know, this widespread closures. Peter Buray, who's sort of the protagonist of the book, refers to it as a fire sale of American churches. He did not do what they wanted to, what they asked of him in that petition. But what is interesting is that they're starting now in the Signatura, which is basically the Vatican Supreme Court, to tell these bishops who have closed churches. Now, these are churches where people have spent money and hired a canon lawyer in Rome and filed formal protests. You can't just hold a press conference and think that the Vatican monitors CNN, if you get on CNN. What the Signatura has done increasingly now is they're telling bishops, okay, you can close the church, but you can't sell it. And the term they use is you cannot relegate it from sacred use to profane use. And profane use simply means, in canon law, that it is no longer a sacred space and can therefore be sold. So some of these bishops now are running into problems. They want to sell churches. They have to close, or they close them first, and then they're getting rulings that are telling them, well, you can close it, but you can't sell it. So they're in a kind of canon law limbo.
That's very interesting. They can't desacramentalize,
right,
whatever that's called. Courtney is in New Orleans on Coast to Coast on a wild card line for neighbor Jason Berry. Go ahead, Courtney.
Thank you. Thanks for taking my call. My question is about purgatory. There's theories that the Catholic theory on purgatory is kind of original on its own, and that it might be also kind of a money-making device, for memorial masses. And I also believe that they are kind of ditching that theory, just kind of your general take on purgatory.
That's interesting.
What I wanted to know about.
That's good. Because that also brings up the subject which we really haven't talked about tonight, and that was the marital dispensations too. Jason,
I'm sorry, I didn't hear your last part, Ian.
I was just talking about how they were making the changes on, they were giving permission for the annulments, and right? I mean, that had just been something which had just been, you know, a rubber stamp for the American church, and she's talking about purgatory. Was it at one time kind of a financial gambit that people would be giving money to get people out of purgatory?
Well, she's talking about indulgences, which is sort of like selling a get out of jail free card to get to heaven. The simony actually is the correct term during the earlier history periods of church history. I don't know if purgatory was deemed no longer a sort of a believable zone because of that or not. But as far as marriage annulments go, the annulment system has got a lot of critics, including canon lawyers. And one of the cases I cite in this book involved Congressman Joseph Kennedy, the nephew of Senator Ted Kennedy. And when he and his wife divorced, this is about 10, 15 years ago, he applied for an annulment in order to remarry in the church, and his wife did something rather rare. She protested the annulment. Now, she was an Episcopalian, and her view was that even though the marriage did not work out and they divorced, they had two sons, that the marriage had been valid, and there was no reason to have an annulment that would say, well, the marriage was not valid. It went back and forth for 10 years with legal opinions within the canon law system on both sides of the Atlantic. And in the end, the Vatican ruled for Kennedy's ex-wife, and he was not granted the annulment. By that time, he had been remarried for several years.
Yeah. A similar thing happened to a friend of mine from college who converted to Catholicism, I believe, in order to marry her longtime boyfriend. They broke up after 3 or 4 years after marriage, but it was because of sexual issues. And I won't go into it, but it was nothing she was doing. And as far as she was concerned, she was 100% committed to him, went to all the therapy, worked with the priest. He left and he went and found somebody else that he wanted to be with more. And he did get an annulment. And she was so mad about that because she said, do I get my virginity back? Is that what I, is that, she said, do I get some sort of certificate now that says that never happened? Because, you know, she'd been saving that all that time. All right, let's go to David in Spokane on Coast to Coast, west of the Rockies for Jason Berry. Go ahead, David.
Yes, Jay. I don't know if Jason's ever heard about this, but it's quite common knowledge here in Spokane that they had these shyster lawyers that were running around Spokane at the time of the abuse, and they were picking up homeless people and derelicts in the downtown area and telling them, you know, to sign this legal form to be in the lawsuit. And some of them weren't even Catholics. And they're just rounding up people to get a bigger settlement out of the church and whatnot. And a second thing I wanted to ask him about was that even though, you know, that you're using a lot of figures for a lot of large figures that may sound like a lot of money slushing around the Vatican, you have to point out that the church also runs universities, high schools, elementary schools, orphanages, hospitals, recovery centers. The list just goes on and on. Catholic Charities just goes out of its way to help people when Hurricane Katrina came to
Sure. I don't think anybody's I'm not sure that anybody's talking about that. So let me be very clear. Go ahead, Jason. You want to respond?
Well, the gentleman raises a very good point about the social services that the church provides. I don't know anything about the lawyers in Spokane one way or the other. I just have no knowledge.
I've never heard that either.
But I'm glad he makes the point about the safety net. You know, one of the points I make every time I give a speech, invariably there's some very hostile anti-Catholic who gets up and has a, you know, stem winder of a question. And I make the point, you don't want the Catholic Church to fail. And the reason for that is because Catholic Charities USA is one of the largest social service providers in this country. It is integral to the American social safety net. The work that is done for battered women, for soup kitchens, for the homeless is quite extensive. And I think that historically has been the church's great role in the United States, that and the welcoming of immigrant peoples, wave after wave, generation after generation. And one of the reasons I wrote this book, as a Catholic myself, is in hopes that it will be, you know, part of that movement toward a humane equilibrium and bringing back a balance in the way the church is run. But I do thank you, sir, for that good question.
Yeah, I think David is actually misinterpreting some motive or making an assumption there, because so much of what you're talking about is just getting the house back in order. Anybody would want this, David. Anybody, if you found out that somebody in your household had a gambling addiction and all of this hard-earned money that you've been working on was going out the door to some bookie, it would just seem wrong. And that's what so much of what Jason writes about in the new book, Render Unto Rome. It's about justice, and it's the secret life of money in the Catholic Church. And especially if you're Catholic, I think you should read this book, and you should work toward greater accountability, greater transparency, and hopefully an end to all of this waste when it does, in fact, happen, so that the money can be used for the intended purposes that folks gave it in the first place. Thank you so much. Hope you enjoyed it again. I know we throw a lot at you when you're on Coast to Coast, so you keep writing them, Jason Berry, and we'll keep talking about them.
Ian, thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
All right. Look forward to seeing you when you're in town, too. And just remember, too, don't let this stop you from making a contribution. Just, you know, maybe think about better, give more intention to where you'll be contributing your money. Lots of people out there deserve it and need it, especially in these hard times. Deus te amat. And I do, too.